Harvard University and Harvard Law School. I think this has been a wonderful conference, just a perfect setting. They couldn't have done more for us than they've done. They've been perfect hosts for a wonderful, wonderful conference. So I hope that we'll remember the Berkman Center for what they've done. And let me introduce the executive director, Eric Saltzman, who is going to start off our program, and Dan Markell, who is a fellow. But let's give him a round of applause for being absolutely perfect hosts. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm Eric Saltzman, executive director of the Berkman Center at Harvard Law School. You've been focusing on all of your work and the future. So I'll just put in a plug. The Berkman Center is an internet law and public policy center at Harvard Law School that was established about 4 years ago. And it works and was established with the understanding that this is a new space we're working in. We all have a lot to learn, so we are experimental as we go at our center and have programs in many of the fields you're working in. And I really extend to all of you my thanks for coming and working at Harvard Law School, but also an invitation for the future to look at our site and contact us, our fellows and students, if you have questions or tricky problems you're interested in talking about. We're going to talk about location technologies today and the problems, legal and social problems, that they introduce. And I think it's appropriate that I'm standing here. This is actually me in one place, and looking at the projector, we have information and location technology information projected on my forehead. So it's almost inescapable. I wanted to make one allusion to the past. I know there are people outside the legal profession who say that lawyers never learn and they don't really learn for the past. We're always stuck in the same issues and chewing over the same sawdust that's been chewed before. But I saw yesterday when I was over in Austin and wanting to use the restroom, realizing that I'd forgotten the key code, I went up to one of your people at the desk upstairs, and she said that I didn't need the code because you'd taped over the locks. So, obviously, even though it's reaching back a little bit, you've at least learned from Watergate, and you're bringing the lesson forward to today. Now, for those of you who are younger, you can lean to the person next to you, and they'll explain it. So what we want to do today is have not a lecture, certainly, and really a discussion. And we're quite sure that the people in this room know as much as we do and have as much insight as we do into these problems and questions. This technology is on the road, literally on the road, to being ubiquitous. So I know some of you have easy passes or whatever the local traffic and tunnel payment system is. I wonder if individually you've thought about your use of that pass, what it says about the record it says about where you are, where you've gone. My father, who is 84 years old, when I got one of these a few years ago living in New York, he said that he would never want one because then his wife, my mother, his first and only wife, would know when he was visiting his mistress in Fort Lee, New Jersey. So there are small problems like that. I think she probably knew anyhow. There are small problems like that, and then there are many, many bigger problems as well. What I'm learning as I go along in this field is that the ways, the means, the methods, the technologies of locating individuals or devices that they carry, use, or attach to is really on a big ramp up. It's my personal feeling that most Americans, unless faced with a real immediate painful problem, will usually choose convenience over most other values. And so when they have a technology like a cell phone or like an easy pass or some other device, that does keep and store or enable the storage of information about where they have been, what they do, what they buy, and think ahead to, well, maybe sometime that might cause me a problem. Generally, those individuals will choose the convenience of having the device, and these devices that were once called convenient will become more and more important to us. I think the question you will all ask yourselves is, is it your job as attorneys general or the individuals in your offices to lead and try to make policy and figure out what the regime should be in which these devices operate, or should you simply go along in a protection function or some other function? Do you need consumers to tell you what to do when consumers may not see what's coming, may not care about it? So that's an issue. I could go on. I want to get us started with the program. So I'm going to introduce Dan Markell, who is a fellow at the Brookings Center, a recent graduate of Harvard Law School. Before Dan comes up, just to get you rocking and rolling as you eat lunch, I want to show you a brief demonstration, 30 seconds or so, that's on a site called Digital Angel that offers a use for devices that can locate.
A tip-off to the type of thing we're going to be looking at today. First, I want to thank Cedar Pruitt, who's also at the Berkman Center, for helping us out in terms of technology. What we want to do for the remaining hour is we want to spend the first few minutes having a demonstration of this technology. We have Howard Lerner from Verizon, and we have Ed Friedman from Teletype, and they're going to demonstrate the uses of the technology in various ways. What we want to do after that is we're going to have you brainstorm. This is going to be a Socratic seminar. So think back, you're back at Harvard Law School. For some of you, you're alumni, some of it's your first time. We're going to put you back in the first year, and we're going to call on people randomly, maybe from the state, maybe from their name. So get ready, because we're going to have you think about a particular series of questions, and then we're going to do some interactive seminar-style teaching afterwards, trying to think about the unfolding legal and social implications of this technology. So I think we'll start first with Howard Lerner, Verizon, and Howard, let me give you a microphone.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Howard Lerner. I'm the Associate Director of Wireless Data at Verizon Wireless, and I'm responsible for wireless data network in New England. Eric asked me to come here today to talk about location technology, and I have some examples of some partnering that we've done with some business partners that provide the solution. This map that we have up on the wall is a customer of ours running vehicles throughout eastern Massachusetts and Rhode Island. A vehicle that, Cedar, why don't you stay right there, truck number 7900, last located at 12:56 p.m., 41 miles an hour, heading east. A square icon is a unit at rest. So that was stopped there for 3 minutes. Once you go to another one, and there might be a longer stop. It just came to stop. But there's other ones where they've been stopped for an hour or two. This is a fleet management program that this company would want to use to track their vehicles, not only for productivity, but also for customer service. Imagine a customer maybe in southeastern Massachusetts on Route 3 who needs a pickup or delivery. If the dispatcher doesn't know where the vehicles are, it's very difficult for him to dispatch appropriately, especially if it's an emergency. Maybe it's something that needs to be done right away. So he normally would have to go on a two-way radio or cell phone system to try to page a lot of his drivers to see who can go down to southeastern Massachusetts on Route 3 on a Friday afternoon in the summertime with all the Cape traffic to take care of this customer. And of course, when he calls everybody on the phone, everyone says that they're not anywhere near that area and that they're too busy. So this way he can say, well, you know, truck number 8800, you're on, you know, you're down on 495, you're only about 20 minutes away. If you're done for the day, why don't you just head on over there? So it's a productivity tool, it's a customer service tool, as well as it's a asset tracker. So once you go to the text version, okay, and once you hit refresh, and we'll get like a, just refresh the screen. What this is what a dispatcher can look at. Can look at either a map or can look at a text version, hit vehicle status. Can see a text version of that same information. So this fleet actually has 37 vehicles, and the GPS location goes down right to the street address. So if you see vehicle 6000, last located 1236, it's on Highway 5 in West Springfield, Camden County, Massachusetts, and it's parked for the last 15 minutes. And there's other ones. You can see truck 7000 is going 70 miles an hour on 140. In New Bedford, okay? Now, this company may or may not have some sort of incentive program for their drivers. We have partners. We do have business partners. We have customers that use this as an incentive to their drivers by saying, if you stay below 65 miles an hour, we will give you some sort of monthly stipend or bonus. If you break those rules, then we won't. And it reflects in their insurance premiums and the like. You can go to, Cedar, why don't you click on our reports, and let's see what this guy's doing on truck number 7000. So select down to 7000, and let's go change the date to April 23rd, and now hit generate report. What it's going to do is we're going to get all his activity every 15 minutes from yesterday through today. And it's going to show all his stops. So the first stop, this guy started at 3 o'clock in the morning. His first stop was at 3:55 in the morning for 5 minutes. His next stop, 6:10. So this guy's moving. Not doing too many stops. Keep scrolling down. See if we can find some more stops. Yep. Okay, there's a yellow one. Stopped for 23 minutes. You can color code this thing. So basically how this works, Not to get too into this, this detail, is that there's a box that I'm holding in my hand. It gets installed into a vehicle. It gets hooked up to constant power so that even if the vehicle is shut off, the unit is still active. And it has a memory chip inside of it as well. As the vehicle is moving throughout its day, the GPS location is captured by this GPS receiver, which is attached to the box. This is mounted outside the vehicle. When it's time to transmit its data, the cellular modem inside this box, it's integrated, transmits via the internet back to a website and a server in California where that information is stored for 2 weeks. The customer passwords into the website and can look at their information. So it's pretty secure. There's enhancements that you customer can do. The customer can buy a keyboard that attaches to the back of this box, and they can do text messaging dispatch back and forth between the driver and the dispatcher. So that's what the solution is, and we've been very successful selling it in New England, and it runs on the Verizon Wireless Network. Why don't we go to NextBus? This is a new company out of California as well, and they're coming to Boston. They're working with the MBTA. But this is currently a real site that they have up in San Francisco. And imagine, if you will, the ability to either go to your desktop computer or your WAP phone or your PDA and be able to find out when the next bus is due to the bus stop that you want to go to, especially in New England with the weather, the winter that we just had. Imagine if you work in an office building and maybe on a Saturday or Sunday, that bus only comes once an hour, and it may or may not be that reliable. This way you'd be able to go to their website and actually see where that vehicle is. And there's actually, the prior page, Cedar, shows a prediction as to when that bus will be arriving. So at this bus stop, there's three buses en route, one coming in 4 minutes, one coming in 9 minutes. And you see that last one went from 14 to 16 minutes, so it must have been stuck in traffic. Okay, so not only were you able to see a text version, but you'd be able to look at the map. And at the bus stops themselves and the train stations, there's going to be ruggedized poles. Right now, there's poles on the ground that might have a bus route and a timetable as to when stuff is scheduled. Instead of having that, they'll have a fluorescent display screen telling you that the next bus comes in 3 minutes, 9 minutes, or 15 minutes. Very similar if you've been in Atlanta's airport and you take those trams underneath the terminals and it says train approaching, train arriving, and all that stuff. You're going to have the same type of thing at the bus station, all live information. And again, all of this wireless data traffic is running across our network. So these are, you know, pretty innovative ways that you can use GPS and wireless data in real applications today.
Great.
For those of you who don't know what GPS is, I'll just tell you very quickly. It's a system of satellites. There are numerous satellites in geosynchronous orbit, and they transmit down to receivers as small as what Howard showed you. They're used for navigation, originally put up by Defense Department, but now available to everyone. Originally, the signal was degraded so that the Defense Department had location accuracy to within a few meters, and the rest of us had less than that, and now the Defense Department has stopped degrading the signal, so the signals are very accurate. And these are the same things you buy for your car that show location and that sort of thing. We were going to seat people or ask the people to be seated by consumer protection sides of the office on one side and law enforcement people on the other side, and I couldn't decide whether then you'd be sitting with your friends or wouldn't be able to sit with your friends. And we were going to have the attorneys general sitting in the middle and have each side pulling on them, and then we thought they wouldn't get to eat. This program here, this idea of watching buses, probably makes everybody in the room comfortable. We're going to talk about some technologies and uses that may not make you all so comfortable. For the moment, we're talking about GPS, but the cell phone itself, which is sometimes, I refer to it myself as a phone, isn't just a phone, but in its ability to find and make handshakes with cellular sites, it needs to communicate all the time. Many of you may already understand this, whether or not you're talking. So you have the option of turning the thing off, and then it's a lead sinker in your pocket. Off means off. Or if it's on and able to receive calls, the system, the network, must always know more or less where you are. And with triangulation techniques, it can find out pretty closely where you are, maybe within a few hundred yards. The solutions to the E911 mandate companies are using basically two solutions. The GPS solution, which has a GPS in the handset, a receiver, and then transmits out. And then the triangulation of simply the handset to the cells, which the network keeps track of. I want to ask Ed Friedman, whose company is Teletype, to show you some GPS technology that may not make you so comfortable.
Do you want to? Ed's got lots of toys here.
Now I'll land up on my toys. Thank you for inviting me. I spoke with Eric a couple days ago, and he invited representatives and me specifically to come out to this conference, and first my reaction was, well, why should I come out and be grinded by questions I might not like? But then I thought, well, I will come out and say that my son wants to get in Harvard. Okay, so the technology that, just a little bit about Teletype, because Teletype is not, of course, is known as Verizon. We started a long time ago in 1982 and been involved in the graphics and developing better and faster maps. Our core of our business is a car navigation. As it started getting evolved as business, people were saying, well, that's fine that I know where I am, but I would like to know other people where I am in case there is an emergency, in case there is, like it was, Howard was discussing, a blown up tire, or I want to know where my truck is. My truck driver needs the map, but I would like to know how my truck driver performs. So we specialize in a miniature type system, smaller and smaller GPS. This is the whole GPS system on this little car. If I put it into pocket computer, I can drive, it will tell me turn right, turn left, door to door routing. It could tell me the location of points of interest. If I put another car, like this, this is set of a digital packet data card. That card can transmit my position. So now you can have, you can sit at home with your computer and see the position of the driver or a person that walks in the street if you would like to. Or with this computer, I can see position of other CDPD GPS devices. It's very simple and very easy to use. It's towards consumers. Now, if this is based on a CDPD system, which is kind of a local system, there's a lot of gaps. It works very well in the cities, but it does not work very well outside of major cities. So another device that we have is based on a satellite. So GPS satellites, they're always there, and you don't have to pay for them. People say, how come? Let's say on April 15th you pay for that. So it's always there. But then there are the commercial satellites that you can send to them information. They're relatively big devices at the present time. So if this device emits a packet with the GPS information, that no matter where you are, United States, South America, on the top of Kilimanjaro, it doesn't matter. We always will know where that is. This also device allows you to communicate to the central station and back. So those devices consist of three parts. The GPS, that's the receiver, just to receive the position so you can see where it is. Then you have a transmitter that could be transmitting over the satellite, over the phone system, over CDPD, whatever the new networks will come out. And the GPS system also, it doesn't have to be US GPS system, it could be European GPS system, it could be US GPS system, a Russian GPS system. So, and then you have a controller that ties those two together and makes them talk and makes the whole thing to function. Now, let's jump to the page where we can just show those devices. That's catalog the favorite, yeah. I want to show just one more device, the phone tracker. This device looks like, I didn't take it with me, but it looks like a regular phone. And if the person walks with this phone and I want to know the location, and the first person will have to punch something in to authorize from now on to transmit the position. So if somebody walks with this phone, I can call this phone from the computer. Without the ringing, the phone will give you the position of the individual. Or I can just call and chat with the person on the phone. Who are our customers? Our customers, really, it's not necessarily big corporations, not necessarily small individuals, it's just anybody. We have people by our devices. We have army buys by our devices. We have commercial vehicle tracking. We have when it's a family dispute, people buy. We have when parents want to track their child, they do that. We have detectives that buy. We have FBI that buys it. So what our system is a bit different than other systems that you saw at Track is that we do not post our information on the web. In other words, if you know the password information of some vehicle tracking systems, then you can get into the web and see where the truck is. In our case, it's a bit different. In our case, your central station is in your desktop. That's kind of a difference between the two.
So Ed, may I ask you a couple of quick questions?
Yes.
If there were a child at home, a child of driving age,
yes.
You were concerned where he went.
Yes.
If you wanted to lend him your car for a couple of weeks and tell him to just, here's the keys and here's some gas money, how would you be able to watch where he drove?
You can do that. You can definitely do that. And we know it's been done. They give their car and they later get in touch with police and tell where the child buys drugs.
How about if you wanted to put this device on somebody's car, not you, if one wanted to buy your device and put it on somebody's car, is it difficult to do?
No, it is not difficult to do. It's just you need the 12 volts.
Okay. And that phone tracker, which costs almost $1,000, I know I can go buy a cell phone for $100. That $900 difference buys you something.
It buys you central station at home,
mm-hmm.
and it buys you GPS inside the phone that's produced in a small quantity. Someday it will change. You're right. It's not going to be.
So if an individual or a company or an office or an attorney general's office wanted to give those phones to their family or employees and said, here's your new phone, the employee wouldn't necessarily know that their location could be monitored from the office or from the living room.
I guess if they don't want to read the manual, that comes to that.
Okay.
Excellent. 99% of our customers.
Okay. Great. Thank you, Ed.
We're very grateful to Ed and to Howard for coming out here and doing these demonstrations. What we want to do now for the next 5 minutes is brainstorm at your tables. Think about three questions. You might think of this as first generation technology with respect to location-based services. So think about the potential uses in terms of the beneficial uses. Second, think about the potential abuses or disadvantages of using this technology in terms of it becoming ubiquitous and penetrating virtually every aspect of our lives as consumers and citizens. And third, we want you to think about over the next 5 minutes, how does this technology differ from other technologies that exist with respect to the law? So you might think about, how does this differ from credit card information? How does this differ from phone logs? That type of thought might come into your mind. We want you to think about that for the next 5 to 10 minutes while Eric and I eat a quick lunch. And then we're going to do some brainstorming afterwards because, in fact, the law is pretty open on this area. And we want to sort of use this brain trust that we have here to start to think about the organizing principles that should develop and that should constrain the use of this technology over time. So that's your task for the next 5 minutes. Think about the uses, the abuses, and how it differs, if at all. If not, tell us why also. that's not very. Really? That's so good. Okay, I think we're going to start now. Okay. So, let's start now. We just want to start to think about some of the potential uses. If I could have everyone's attention, we want to start, perhaps we'll start with some potential uses. So, Bill Sorrells here from Vermont, why don't I call on you first? Maybe you can represent your table. What were some of the uses your table came up with for this technology? Okay, well, let's get a few more on the board for uses. Bill, since you were sitting next to me, perhaps I can call on you, actually. Okay. Right, so there's actually Digital Angel has this technology where if you're fallen down for more than 3 minutes, they will send off their angels in that direction. Then it's like gives new meaning to the help I've fallen and I can't get up. Navigation. Dean Rickman, what happened at your table there?
Those who rented a truck to blow up the World Trade Center might have a more difficult time avoiding detection if this technology had been in place then.
Okay, so that's another example of the law enforcement box. Jim Tierney, what have you got from your table?
Well, I think it's going to change discovery and divorce cases, Revan.
Now, does that count as a use or abuse?
That's all right. That's all we talked about over here. It's going to change Tony Soprano's whole way of doing business. And other than that, we have nothing to say.
We need to know how many of you in this table are on your first marriage.
Cassandra, where did I see you? There you are. Cassandra, tell us from your you were at the sales table also. Did you come up with any other? Do you want to tell us about some of the abuses you foresaw?
Some of the abuses?
Yeah.
Well, the potential law enforcement, I mean, you could use it to track somebody without them knowing it.
Okay. So the law enforcement obviously has its perils as well as its promises.
Would you give the microphone to Richard behind you?
Certainly.
Yeah, hi. We our table talked about some of the same issues here, like probation. Now, the one that we didn't talk about that comes up all the time is the apocryphal story about how Starbucks is going to offer coupons.
Good.
And I think about it. Yeah, SMS spam as you walk by the Starbucks, you get your coupon. So I think we ought to talk about that one.
Okay.
Again, which side, we don't know. This is on.
Right. So actually, Richard, on that point, you could imagine a new digital architecture, right? An architecture that lets you transmit the information when you want to have it transmitted to a marketing service. So you can imagine two on-off buttons on your cell phone. One that's always on when you want to receive phone calls as part of the general architecture for which it works. And a second on-off button which would permit the transmission of that information that Verizon might be able to tell you about your location to another marketing service that gives you specific information about where you are at that time. And that would offer, in some ways, a way to rethink the architecture of the code so that you could avoid the precise problems of getting an advertisement from Mike's Car Wash just after you've gotten into an accident on the highway, right? That's the kind of cell phone use you don't want to have to encounter.
Yeah. I think another thing is on the advertisements, there's no sound that comes out of your phone. It's just like a graphic display might be acceptable to people, too.
Okay.
But control is an important issue there.
Right. Okay. So we'll talk about that when we start to think of some of the principles that should possibly govern the use of this technology. Price discrimination is a great one. So how does that work, Bill? Does that come under the good box or the bad box?
Well, the way I'm thinking about it, it's not good, but it would be we track where you buy your gasoline. They're sufficiently sophisticated to be able to set the price at the pump when you roll in, knowing what your habits are and make a couple extra pennies a gallon or whatever. Anyhow, a whole lot of price discrimination.
How about the insurance company in Arkansas that announced last year, I don't know if they went through it, that they were going to, instead of billing annually, bill monthly, put devices in cars that showed how much the cars were driven and exactly where they went, had programs that would then analyze what the risks were and bill accordingly. Is that a beneficial use or is that a detriment? Is that a bug or a feature? And some of these issues are not exactly like, but can be looked at in the way redlining is sometimes looked at.
Okay, so thanks, Bill. So here's the next question. How does it differ? So we have a pretty good sense of some of the uses and abuses. Let's think about now how it differs from other types of information. Is there anything special about location information? Tom Fisher from Indiana.
I think it can be, just in the sense that it gives an instant snapshot. It gives context in some respects, too. It's hard to deny what's going to come out of some of this location technology.
Any other thoughts on location being different? How about Glenn Kaplan from Massachusetts? I spoke with him before.
That's right. Hi. Well, I think that in part it's also different just because of the huge agglomeration of data showing far more specifically than anybody has with any thoughts of virtual clickstream, where you actually are, where you go, to a large extent, who you associate with, when, and then who's keeping the information and holding on to it and for how long. I think it just, using industry term, gets far more granular than I think a lot of people are comfortable with, especially if there really isn't a way to turn the thing off.
I want to ask about the use in court for a minute. As a defense attorney a long time ago in Seattle, a lawyer, my adversary, objected to some testimony in front of a very wry and ironic smart judge. He objected saying, and the judge asked him the grounds, and he said, Your Honor, this testimony is obviously false. And the judge said, now, if we had to screen everything for truthfulness, we'd hardly hear anything now, would we? And denied the objection, of course. So it seems like a very good thing at first when you realize that all witnesses now have to think about the truthfulness of their testimony. Where was I? What record is there of my movements or other information? Who might have it? But you also begin to get a picture of all of us living in a world where it might be that the small fibs are now disabled. I can't really tell somebody for sure that I was somewhere when I was at the Red Sox game tonight. And I wonder if there are concerns that anything happens to the social fabric that we rely upon when there is potentially so much information available. I think you also need to think ahead. We are not futurists at the Berkman Center, and we don't know certainly what's coming, don't want to predict, but certainly there's going to be much more of this information, much more granular, detailed, and much more available, not just to law enforcement and everyone. So I think we have to think about what kind of society we'll end up in. Anybody have any thoughts about that? Is anybody getting queasy about this level of discussion? Who's getting uncomfortable? Patrick.
At our table, we talked about the moral and ethical implications of, say, for example, using some kind of a locator device with your children. You know, is this a really appropriate thing to do? Are you basically telling them, we don't trust you at any level, and so we have to put this device on the car to make sure we know where you're going at all times? What does that do to the relationship?
Patrick, doesn't the norm that might be expressed by that switch when we're concerned about, say, abduction of the child, or if we're concerned that they might get lost, like Spot in New York City from Digital Angel, is it possible that we could be saying something different than, we don't trust you, when we either implant the chip or have you wear a watch which you can decide when it's on and when it's off?
I think a lot of that depends on the age of the kid. We talked about that briefly too, that some kids are younger and, you know, can't control themselves quite as well, and of course there's teenagers that can't control themselves, but you still have to deal with the trust issue at that level.
You can imagine that same monitoring of children would affect, for example, the corporate executive who goes to Columbia and wants to avoid getting kidnapped. So Digital Angel has the guy who invented it, actually invented a chip that can be inserted into your skin, so that the way actually wouldn't be traceable to your wristband, watch that you're wearing, or some other type of device that looks obvious. Does the fact that it should be inserted, that it could be inserted as a chip into your skin, make anyone particularly queasy, or is that just sort of the next step?
I think it all goes to your reasonable expectation of privacy. If you've had a chip inserted in your skin, you've certainly given permission, arguably, you've given permission for that to occur.
What if you're an offender in a prison and we want to save on the cost of monitoring prison guards? Can we insert chips if we have reasonable basis to think that there's not much of a health risk imposed by this? Do we have a right as a society to spend less money on the social resources needed to monitor our offenders, either out of prison or in prison?
I don't have a problem with monitoring once people have left, but it's the insertion of the chip under the skin that sort of is creepy about that.
What if it was an electronic
tether, tether happens all the time, sure.
Right. So can you imagine actually even the electronic bracelet becomes one that constricts if you go outside the zone that you're supposed to be in? Wouldn't that make it much cheaper to run? You put a band around your arm, and if you're leaving the zone which you're supposed to be in, or if you're not in your cell by a certain amount, you just experience the pain in a much, you know, the prisoner is much more likely to be able to control whether he's going to experience, you know,
it's
brutality.
Like the fence, right?
Right. The electric fence for dogs.
Right.
Not that there's an analogy between prisoners and dogs, but.
Well, for me, I think, you know, once you start to inflict physical pain on somebody, it's a little bit different than just merely putting a tether on it and putting them back in jail if they violate the terms and conditions. You know, I have a little bit of a problem with that. What do you think, Amy?
Yeah, Amy, what do you think?
On this one, I definitely agree with you. No questions asked. I mean,
well, you're inflicting the violence on the prisoner, right? He's the one who's inflicting it on himself by not being in the place where he's supposed to be.
I think there's, if nothing else, a concern that something might malfunction and you don't have anyone there to be dealing with that problem.
So then we just sue Ed Friedman for developing these technologies, right? We just put enterprise liability on the producers of this film.
Let me raise another question that's come up. I was recently at a meeting in the office of an attorney, state attorney general, and at that meeting there were some privacy experts, some people from industry, meaning the new industry that's developed in the last 10 years, information and communication technology industry, lawyers, people from the Attorney General's office, and they were talking about the gathering and use of information. And the discussion was basically about privacy, although I'm urging you to think that it's actually much more bigger, a much bigger subject than privacy. Something about privacy doesn't seem to encompass the whole issue. And the discussion in that room, the discussion I kept hearing, was a balancing discussion. And the balance was, here's this industry, it was doing very well, it's getting kicked around a little bit, we focused on our business model and what we're trying to, even if we're not making a lot of money yet, our survival, jobs in your state and big investment depends on being a state that's friendly to this type of business. And these businesses thrive on information communication and information gathering. If we don't have that, we're going to be out of business. If you move, this is just one example because I think the discussion on opt-in, opt-out is too narrow. But if you focus, what I heard from some of the people on the industry side was, if you move us to an opt-in, we are going to lose 85 or 90% of the information that we can sell. And when I left the room, I was wondering, the people in the Attorney General's office, how would they think about this information? Nobody wants to be in the position of putting businesses or nascent businesses, even more perhaps, out of business. And one of the things that I began to think about in my way back home was, what is it that is balanced in this discussion? We're having the same type of discussion now. Or is it a balance of principles, which we're used to doing in law school, or is it a balance of economic power that many of you in public office have to do more of than you'd like, perhaps? And I think being aware of that distinction, I certainly don't have an answer for the problem, may help you reach a result that you're more comfortable with and that works better for your constituents. I'd like to just ask if we can have one quick discussion between someone on the law enforcement side. Many of your offices have more law enforcement responsibilities than other states, but somebody who has a law enforcement responsibility in that office, I ask for a volunteer because I don't know who does. Okay, he's got a microphone right there. And someone, just so it doesn't get nasty, from a different state who has a consumer protection obligation. Who would that be? Somebody want to volunteer? Or maybe we'll hear from the law enforcement side first. And the question is there anything about this technology, anything about the uses that you would walk away from in terms of not because you thought you wouldn't get it, that a court would turn you down, but is there anything about it that you feel goes too far, even in your responsibility as a law enforcement officer? Let's leave out the one about the constricting bracelet.
I wouldn't necessarily say that anything about it pops up that says that law enforcement should be prohibited from using it as a tool, but having said that, though, I think that what we did discuss and what immediately comes to mind for me when I listen to this discussion is that for electronically stored information, there's a fairly settled body of law regarding what kinds of legal process the government needs to use in order to gather this information. You're talking about developing whole hosts of possible kinds of stored electronic information that's very specific as to personal privacy, about which I don't think that body of law is directly related.
Well, we don't know.
Therefore, the problem that I see, and it is in a way, it's not only that therefore a court might throw out a case, it's also that since we deal with the rule of law, and it's crucial for law enforcement to make sure that everything that we do is consistent with the rule of law, that when we gather information, we're doing so consistent with that rule of law. So what I'm saying is that we would need to have in place the appropriate type of restrictions on law enforcement's ability to gather this information so that when we did gather it, it would be consistent with rules. And so that's my concern about it from law enforcement standpoint.
I know we're about to run out of time. I just want to There were many things we wanted to cover. There's one, if we didn't at least mention, we would have liked to have it come out in discussion. We've been talking about, and I'm sure you have too, the difference between knowing something for a moment, whether it's whether the network of cell phones knows it for a moment, and the storage and access of that information. And we've been thinking about, Dan and I and others, how one could develop a regime where information is available for the moment when necessary, but not stored on a network, just as a consequence of using a cell phone or being an employee or all the rest of it. And some kind of balance there, not of economic power, but of some principles that we could find that make sense.
I think one other point that we want to leave you to consider is who should be deciding this. Right now, the FCC is in a period of, they're taking comments on whether or not there should be a rulemaking that addresses location-based service information in particular. So what I want to have you all thinking about in terms of not simply your social engineer caps as lawyers, but also as your role as AGs and as AGs for states. So should the federal government preempt here? Should they set a floor? Should they set a floor which is also going to serve as a ceiling? Or how would you imagine the relationship between state law and federal law on this? And should there be, how can we think of global issues that become important here as well? Is this the type of issue that needs possibly to be thought out through international organizations like the WTO, or the UN has bodies that govern technology as well? So these are some of the issues that we want to leave you to ponder. I think Eric and I are inclined at some point soon to write a policy proposal which will hopefully serve as an organizing principles framework for people to think about this. If people have ideas that they want to share with us, we'd be more than happy to do that, and we look forward to your feedback. So thanks very much.
Thank you to both. Thank you. Well, I have the task of distributing a few of our gifts, tokens of appreciation to various people associated with the conference. So first let me start with the Berkman Center people, and Eric Saltzman, you've heard from, and Dan Markell, and I think we have something that will inform us all whenever you use the men's room. For any purpose. Then there's Jonathan's not here now, is he? So we're going to make sure Christina is able to take something back to Jonathan Zittrain for us for his wonderful presentation. And then also, do you have him? Okay. We lost him yesterday morning for a short time, too. Christina Ritchie from the center also. So thank you to those four for their assistance. And you want to, did you were going to say something here? I don't think you are. Okay.
Again, I want to thank you for your attention and your participation. I've not held public office, but I know that it can be at times a cold and difficult place to be when you've got to make tough decisions, and we have something to help build through those tough times here. Do we? I think this is one you need to unwrap right now and hold up. Okay. There we go. Thank you. And I want to also thank you for your gift to me. I actually did very little from our side to make this happen. I had all of the fun, and the person who did the most from the Berkman Center to make all this happen was Christina Ritchie, who's been working and contacting with all of you since October. And so she's the one who deserves the thanks from all of you. And thanks to Cedar Pruitt, who sat here and drove the demonstration for us.
The Massachusetts staff, of course, starting with Tom, the staff leader, but also we want to make sure to acknowledge all the efforts that Chief Deputy Dean Richland and Diane McDonald, Jennifer Austin, Jack Kristen, and Pamela Coquette. Thank you all very much for your assistance in making this a successful conference. Do you know how to identify each of these people? Okay, good. I want to thank Susan Hendrickson and Elsa Ortiz Cashin from my staff for their participation, and the NAG staff, all obviously beginning with Chris and Lynn for their leadership and help, but those that we often don't acknowledge and need to, Angela Davis-West, Kim Hurd, Dennis Cuevas, and Sheila Rahming, thank you all very much for your assistance. We're done with this segment, and we'll be back in the ropes room. Oh, we're going to a different place.
Back to the courtroom by 2:15, please.
My daughter.
check.